thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post-9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran. Before we begin this week's episode, I want to share a book I recently finished by Kensington Publishing. American Fly Girl by Susan Tate Ankeny chronicles the amazing true story of Hazel Ying Lee, an unrecognized pioneer and unsung World War II hero who fought for a country that discriminated against her gender, race, and ambition. Inspired by Amelia Earhart and America's fledgling aviation industry, Hazel was the first Chinese-American woman in U.S. history to earn a pilot's license and fly for the military as a member of the Women's Air Force Service Pilots, or WASPs. Now, I'd heard of the WASPs, but really knew nothing about them or their incredible stories until reading this book. American Fly Girl, the true story of Hazel Ying Lee, who followed her dreams against all the odds and became an American hero, is written by Susan Tate Ankeny and goes on sale April 23rd, 2024, wherever fine books are sold.
This week on the Fighter Pilot Podcast.
It's extremely violent, it's extremely loud, and it's been proven for years and years to be very effective and largely very, very safe.
U.S. Navy Commander and former Landing Signal Officer Jack Curtis joins us to describe the equipment, policies, and procedures necessary to land a high-performance jet aircraft on an aircraft carrier in the daytime. Kick it. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Fighter Pilot Podcast, the internet radio show that explores the fascinating world of air combat. I am Vincent Aiello, your host, and if that introductory song and communications bumper sounded familiar, that's because it's from episodes 11 and 12, which began our current series on carrier operations. It continues here today in episode 13 with Jack Curtis, where we will talk day carrier landings and equipment part one. This episode is brought to you in part by our patron strike lead, Bill Horvath. If you want to see what Bill is doing, go over to patreon.com and search Fighter Pilot Podcast and take a look at the exclusive material you can gain access to if you decide to join Bill and the others. We have a goal set up on there. If we reach a certain amount, we will take this show and increase it from 3 times a month to 4. So if you're interested in that, take a look, consider signing up, helping us to not only offset the cost of producing this show, but again, giving you access to exclusive content. All right, we have a great interview coming up, and I want to let you know that we had a survey recently on Facebook where you, the listener, decided by a slight margin to continue the current status quo of keeping plenty of time for listener questions, but also taking our interviews, which are getting longer, and breaking them up like we did on episodes 11 and 12. So we're going to do that again today with Farva, and this will be part one on day carrier landings. Now, our listener segment today is coming from a Facebook Live session I did with Brian Sinclair, Sunshine. You remember him from episode one. He's the one who told us what it means to be a fighter pilot and how you become one. So what I did is took our Facebook Live session, and it is edited just a little bit for content and clarity, plus some of the humor is lost when you only hear it and don't see it. And I'm going to replay the highlights here for our listener question segment, and then I'll come back in before we get to the interview. All right, so let's go to listener questions with Sunshine and Jello. All right, guys, well, we're going to get to the questions here, and we're just going to free flow this. And I'll just start by asking you the first question, then add to it. And then if you want, you can ask me the second one. Ah, this is apropos for you, actually.
Uh-huh. Okay.
This is from Austin from Boise, Idaho. He says, I have a question regarding Navy Test and Evaluation Squadrons, VX.
Sounds familiar.
I believe you were in one of those.
I was.
Which one?
VX-31.
31, okay.
The dust devils out of China Lake.
China Lake, California, near Ridgecrest. Mm-hmm. What do these members do? How does one get into one of these squadrons? And how does it benefit a pilot when they return to the fleet? So let's take it from the beginning there. What do these members do?
Austin, great question. Firstly, entrance criteria, if you will, the way you get into a VX squadron is going to be through test pilot school. So there are two accepted paths, if you will. One's the U.S. Air Force test pilot school, of which I'm an alumnus, I guess, and then the Navy test pilot school. So that's how you get in. Now, once you get there, what you're doing is you are an airborne engineer. So during the school, they're going to teach you how to write effectively to communicate. You already know how to fly, ideally. That's come to you with the 3+ years of fleet experience you had prior to the test pilot school, yeah. But now they're going to hone your skills a little bit because, from my perspective, you had to capture data points that required tight tolerances on airspeed, altitude, angle of bank, and whatnot. So you spend a lot of time focusing on very precise, usually single ship flying, as in, hey, I need to maintain this heading plus or minus 2 degrees, this airspeed plus or minus 10 knots. And you have to be able to talk as things are going on because there are guys. Sometimes they actually videotape your cockpit and they see your displays and it's showed via telemetry to the ground. Sometimes it's just an audio relay. So you actually have to talk to the engineers and help them to experience what you are airborne. Right. And when you run into contingencies or when you run into emergencies actually or non-standard things in the cockpit, then you have to be able to convey exactly what's going on in the cockpit. And then you have to basically run through your decision matrix with the engineers, which would be a guy on the ground, and then effectively and efficiently come up with a solution.
So what are you doing, though, this test for? The aircraft itself or some weapons or software?
Thank you. For China Lake, VX-31 and VX-9, what we do is weapons test. And then VX-23 is in Patuxent River, Maryland, and that's the aircraft division. So I specifically work with anti-surface weapons.
Oh.
So that would be blowing up ships. How do we blow up ships
right.
and whatnot? So I got to test some very new variants of weapons that actually had Wi-Fi on board. So we call that Link 16, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we had, they're called, the family of weapons is called net-enabled weapons. Mm. And I got to launch the first Tomahawk that actually was, you have a target, you dump the target coordinates into the weapon, you release the weapon, and now because it's Wi-Fi enabled, you can actually update the target coordinates or you can change it to a new target, provided the kinematics work out so it can still get to the target.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
All right, so Austin wants to know, how do you get into one of these squadrons? I guess you talked about the requirement to have been a test pilot school graduate, but then do you just show up and say, hey, I'm here? Do they pick you or is there a rush?
No, there's no rush. So basically, for VX-31 specifically, you have to be a test pilot graduate.
Okay.
And then from there, you're farmed out. It's going to be a detailer who's kind of the flesh peddler, if you will, of the Navy, and he's going to look at needs of the Navy and see where you need to go.
That is a disturbing term.
Sorry about
don't
that.
Don't use that again.
Okay, I won't.
But you don't need to be a TPS graduate to go to VX-9.
Correct.
Do you for 23? Those guys do like a lot of the carrier suitability stuff.
To my knowledge, they are TPS
okay.
grads.
Yeah, right,
because there's two flavors of tests, sorry, Joe.
Yeah,
there's
nope,
developmental tests where you're looking to make sure that the platform adheres to the specifications or specs of the contract, if you will. And then OT, or operational test, is VX-9, and they're going to kind of apply the operational aspect of it and look for suitability and effectiveness, if you will, of the weapon system.
So they are the conduit between the people with the very big brains in the engineering and the people with the very big chests, if you will, out in the fleet.
Yes.
These guys are in the middle and kind of translating it to
yep.
everybody out there. All right. And then how does it benefit a pilot when you return to the fleet?
So going back to the fleet, you have firsthand experience with a lot of emerging technologies. And those emerging technologies are going to reach initial operational capability, IOC, and they'll be introduced to the fleet, and you are going to be heavily leaned upon in your carrier air group, or your CAG, basically, to be an on-site, I guess you'd call it, subject matter expert. Specifically, the Hornet or the Super Hornet, they're both electric jets, so they're run off predominantly software, so they're very software-intensive, if you will. So one of the things we did is with weapons integration is also the testing of the different software configurations, if you will. And then we, as they went out to the fleet, we would brief the fleet on them. And some of the guys that finish up their tour at VX would go back into the fleet and they would be the resident subject matter experts.
Okay. So kind of the people that are out there, the missionaries almost, that are right there among the population and helping everybody get to know all this stuff.
Absolutely.
Plus, I have to think that if you're flying that precisely, some of the stuff you said at the beginning, you're just going to be coming out of a tour like that a better pilot, a better thinker, a more globally oriented person as far as the experiences that you just encountered.
I would say, and also just, yeah, absolutely critical thinking skills, mm-hmm. I guess you could say, get enhanced, but also your communication skills. Because talking in the fleet, it's a very high standard of person that is in a fighter attack squadron. But then introducing another subset of people, if you will, and those would be the engineers, making sure you can talk to them from their perspective so they understand. First-hand experience. That is the key. That is the key.
All right. So I think that's it for that one. Why don't you take that next one?
Yeah, Jello. So this is from Bill in Australia. So okay. G'day, mate. Bill asks, do you think the retirement of the F-14 was justified? Though you weren't a Tomcat driver, I'm sure you would have known a few. Were there many whom believe that it is purely political and not that age plus the Hornets being able to complete its roles were the reasons for the replacement? What are your thoughts on the matter?
I don't think it was political. I mean, possibly was there a political side of some aspect of it, particularly the fact that they sped it up towards the end? Mm-hmm. Maybe. But I think we had a conversation about this early on, way back in like episode 2 or 3 about the A-10. And it comes down to the same thing. There comes a point in an aircraft's life where the cost to operate it is not justified by the benefit that it gives the fleet. So, and that's what we're seeing now with the F-18 Hornet is, especially it's incrementally faster, or exponentially, I should say, faster as you get fewer of them because it becomes so much more expensive to operate the few that are there. So my personal opinion on that is that I think it had to do with there came a time where it just became too expensive to operate the F-14, and the capability, to your point, yes, was somewhat able to be covered by the F-18. And there came a date where they said, okay, we're going to sundown it by here. But when they got within a year or two of that, they realized they could do it sooner and it was more cost effective to do it sooner. So they did. And I want to say that was about 2007. Was it a great airplane? Sure. Was it very capable? Absolutely. But I don't think there was any sort of agenda or conspiracy or anything else. I think it just reached the end of its normal life and aircraft do that.
Yeah, what I heard, it was a very objective business decision. It was diminishing returns, just like you had mentioned earlier.
All right, right over to you next. Let's see. This is from Justin. Justin doesn't tell us where he's from. He's got a couple parts question. I'll give you the first one. Okay. Recently, the Air Force has been looking for ways to replace what the A-10 is capable of when it comes to CAS, or close air support. They have reportedly been looking into light attack aircraft, most of which are prop-driven. What are your thoughts on the possibility of new light attack aircraft augmenting U.S. air power?
So light attack, I would also, props, yeah, that's a great idea. So for me, props are fantastic where the density is high, i.e. the altitude is low, for basically propeller efficiency, if you will.
So aerodynamically speaking.
Aerodynamically speaking, I think the propeller is a fantastic solution, if you will, for low altitude, low speed combat. And in this case, for close air support, training your guns in on something, I could see like the A-10, you know, which is its operate envelope is, I believe its employment envelope, let's say that is usually 300 knots and less, as opposed to the Hornets when we're dropping bombs, we're at kind of 450 and above. So I would say the prop option is a fantastic solution, if you will, for low altitude and low speed engagement. And also comes for new light attack aircraft, drones, baby. It's sad. I know.
Come on. You're going to talk us right out of a job.
I know. It's so sad. But if you think about all the limiting factors of what I call the soft pink body in the cockpit, whether it be currency, whether it be rest,
right,
whether it be, well, we'll just say fatigue. We'll call it fatigue. Whether it be disorientation, a lot, even training. The two-year pipeline that you and I enjoyed for $1 million+, how about you just print a computer chip, basically, and keep producing those? So from a business perspective, I see it. But from a, dare I say, emotional standpoint, I think it's a terrible idea, right?
Okay.
But I would say that autonomous new light attack aircraft is definitely a threat for us pilots.
What do you think, though, about the idea of, so for example, I've had questions on the show before about the flight deck looks more and more homogenous as far as different versions. Well, it was
ten
a question.
Cents.
No, it was a question. I had to use the guy's word because I couldn't come up with
that. Oh, that's not your own word.
No,
okay.
But anyway. So the carrier flight deck looks more and more like different variants of F-18. This would arguably be a step in the opposite direction. So now, if you take these aircraft into some foreign theater where it would be employed, if it's alongside F-15s and 16s, now it's a whole other set of propellers and engines and wheels and different parts. Is there a part of you that's concerned about having too many different required pieces and parts and aircraft in a supply system? I mean, it shouldn't matter, but let's face it, today, under austere budgets, it kind of does.
Yeah, absolutely. Another great word, austere. And that's going to be going back to your idea of interoperability, right? Mm. If you can change a part on this plane and put it on that plane and you basically have a common design, you're probably going to cut down both the initial costs and the long-term operating costs because your logistics, your footprint, your logistical footprint is probably more narrow, or logistic chain, I guess you can say, and supportability. So while I understand the idea of having multi-role things that are all built the same way but do different missions, that's great. The light attack, let's think of aviation as a series of compromises. Okay, so no jet is the fastest and also the most maneuverable.
True.
And have the most sensors and whatnot. It's all a series of compromises. Well, we can have the Hornet has bigger landing gear, but it goes a little more slowly, let's say, or carries less and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. So point being is you can only compromise so much, and you're going to have to still have, I believe, some smaller, this says light aircraft in his question, so I'm going to say smaller aircraft to fill some specific niches, I would call it. So.
Okay, excellent. You want to take a second one there?
Yeah, I'm sure this topic is nothing new to anyone in the world of aviation, but the Air Force is desperately in the red when it comes to pilots. Last figures I had seen were that the U.S. Air Force is about 3,000 pilots short, with roughly 2,500 being fighter pilots. In your opinion, what do you think is the root of the shortage, and what do you think can or needs to be done about it?
So this question came up on a podcast I recorded with someone else recently on their show, and I was actually almost frankly surprised at my own answer, because I don't know about you, but well, I guess you don't have a podcast, but a lot of times I just make stuff up as I'm answering it.
Me too.
Because it's all in there, but I don't know the order until it comes out. But what I ended up realizing is several different things. Number one, the economy is doing well. And when the economy is doing well, there are more opportunities outside the military. And when there are more opportunities, specifically the airlines, but also other things like you may want to do, government contracts or whatever, that it's not such a risk to go do those. And when it is more risky, when the economy is doing poorly, people are more likely to stay with what they have, right? It's the old dishwater thing. You don't throw it out till you get the new. So I think right now, because the economy is doing well and the airlines are hiring, I mean, for heaven's sakes, they took me, so you know they must be desperate, that you have more likely that there will be people that want to go out and go do that. The second is that you have an operational tempo these days that is very difficult to sustain. Now, I cannot speak for the Air Force, but the Navy, a lot of the carriers these days, like when we were young, we would go out for 6 months and then we wouldn't go out again for another 18 months, roughly. And that would be our two-year rotation. Now, sometimes you go out for six up to 10 months. You're home for what, 3 or 4 months? Did you ever do one of these?
I never I did a surge cruise.
Oh, surge, as they call it. Okay, I never had to. So anyway, what they'll do is they'll go out for 6 or 8 or 10 months. They'll come back for, what, 3 or 4? And then they go out and do it again.
Correct.
And that gets old. Another thing is that, and I think this is always a tension to manage, but when you come in the military like we did, you're young, you're untied down, if you will. You are full of piss and vinegar, and you want to go fly things and blow stuff up and shoot things down. I mean, you do.
Absolutely.
You're in your 20s. That's what brings you in. And then the people keep you in. But then along comes somebody who steals your heart, and then little ones that steal your heart even more. And you have daughters, so I can't imagine. Yeah. You know, my sons make me want to go to work. I'm just kidding, boys. But, you know, there comes a time where suddenly that becomes more important. So I think that drives you. And then the last one, and this will be the most confrontational. What's the word I want? Can you dig in there and find it?
Start talking, and we'll figure it out together.
That's not confrontational. It's a little risque, I guess. Not risque, but it's, anyway, it'll get there. I hate when I do this. This is why I don't do live stuff too much. I like the medium of being able to record and go later, because then the stallings that I do to try to think of it while I'm rambling about nothing, I can come up with it, but it didn't happen. But anyway, the last thing I would say, the society is changing. I don't think that's news to anybody. I would say, if I may generalize, that most pilots who come to the military are relatively traditional and conservative. Now, that may be not always true, but I think it is. And I would argue that the way society is changing is away from that. And because the military reflects society, the military has to adapt to things and has had policy changes in the last several years. And in fact, there is required training on various things now, right as I was leaving, that was maybe something that certain people of a particular bent don't want to have to think about or learn or be trained on. And so if they are resistant to those types of changes, then it also makes it easy to say, you know, maybe it's just time to move on. maybe if this is the way the military is going, I don't want to be a part of that anymore. And so I'm going to go do something else. So
okay,
it's just a dangerous thing to say, I think, on my part.
Let me offer up, too, if you don't mind, of that whole of, hey, I've had enough kind of thing. The military retirement system, it's targeted basically 20 years. And then anytime after that is gravy. And the folks that extend past 20, fantastic. But I really think that they designed it very well based on what I would consider to be the job or mission satisfaction versus the amount of pain incurred, if you will.
Right.
And just like you said, you become a stakeholder in your kids growing up. And so for me, when the tide started to change from the piss and vinegar to the parental figure, if you will, it was coming back from the second cruise, and it was one of those where you go out 6 months, you're back for 3 months. But when you're back, you're actually up in Fallon. You're away from your duty
station.
Exactly. And then we went back out for four. So they basically stretched out the whole evolution to be almost 13 months. During those 13 months, my girl went through my firstborn, excuse me, was alive. She was born, obviously. So basically after 13 months, I came home, and for the first full day, she was afraid of me.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, you do the big flyover. The news is there. The wives are there. They understand. They have the flags. They have the cookies in the reception. And there's my 1.5-year-old who's afraid of me. So it kind of, you know, kind of gets at you. And eventually those little things build up. Because, I mean, when people thank you for your service and your sacrifice, that's an example of the sacrifice. So anyway, eventually that adds up. And 20 years is a fantastically designed, I would say, longevity or time frame.
Aren't most girls afraid of you?
Well, that's another story. We'll get to that later.
I finally thought of the word. It's not even that big of a word. Controversial.
Oh.
Duh.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, you asked my opinion on why the Air Force is short. I think it's all those things. So, all right. Let's see. This one's to you. How about Scott from Farmington, Massachusetts? Hello, Scott. I have a couple questions, mostly related to episode 4 on ejection seats.
Okay.
It hit home because one of my friends flew with Basher. All right.
Yeah, I know Basher.
Yep.
New.
Many times you hear the term compartmentalization, speaking of big fancy words that start with a C, where there is a focus on the task at hand, blocking out all other distractions. Is this something that you train for? Is it looked for in the screening process, or is it just a common trait of fighter pilots?
I would say it's a learned habit.
I agree.
I don't think they screen for it, but I think it's kind of Darwinism. They're going to put you in an environment that requires you, the kind of survival in the environment requires compartmentalization.
True.
So when Basher perished, unfortunately, and I know you had Bloach on the show, I was on that carrier and I had just landed. So I didn't see the evolution go down.
Okay.
But the thing is, there were guys airborne that had to compartmentalize. Because they were monitoring a radio, they knew what was going on, and some of them saw the whole evolution go on. Mm-hmm. So they had to basically orbit until the ship could maneuver out of the way. But basically, those gentlemen had to compartmentalize. They just saw a potential death, I'm not sure they knew at the time, right? A fatality of someone that they've been cruising with for several months.
Right.
And you know what? That you have to push that aside because you still have to land on the pitching deck.
That's right. And so, you can process it later, but for right now. Yeah. So
I'd say it's an acquired skill, if you will, and I would call it a survival skill.
And I think you bring up a good point, which is if you're unable to do it, maybe subconsciously that is what drives people to someday get out sooner than others, because if it's just going to be so confrontational in your mind to not be able to do that, or if it's so much effort to do it, I think that could lead to your dissatisfaction with the job, and you may be more willing to go versus the people that can say, okay, I have a sick kid at home. My wife just told me on email, but I'm out here. I'm going to not think about it for 2 hours. I'm going to go do what I got to do. And then you get back and then you can pick it up again, almost like hitting pause on a CD player that your song was playing when you left, you pick it back up. I agree with you. I think it takes a little bit of natural ability, but I think you just develop it. And I've never really thought of it as particularly something I'm proud of, I guess. It's just something you do.
It is.
So
I agree.
All right. You want to take his next one? And we're about down to about 15 minutes here to go.
Yeah. When an event occurs, such as a nose gear separating from the catapult shuttle, what happens to the shuttle at the end of the stroke? And then the follow-on is, with that much force, I would anticipate some damage. How long would it take to repair?
Well, a lot of this I don't know the answer to, so I'll wow you with what I do know, which is on episode 12, which just released a couple days ago, Pappy Anduzzi talks about this towards the end of our discussion on the catapults. And he did not specifically say how long it took or what happened to it, but I have to think that the water break that exists at the end of the catapult to stop the catapult shuttle, I guess is what's underneath, or the shuttle's on top, it's the piston underneath, it will be set with its own Venturi and apertures and all the engineering lingo that you probably know better than I, to say, okay, I expect when it gets here, the piston, that it will be going this fast and it will have this much momentum because it's carrying this much weight. And so I will open at this rate to slow it down. And so when it gets there with only the nose gear, because everything else broke off and it's going super fast because it's expecting to have more weight, then you are going to have a problem with that equipment. And again, I don't know, but you were on the ship. Why don't I let you answer this one?
Yeah, well, if you don't mind, so there's momentum, which is MV. So it's
right,
kind of
mass
a linear
times velocity.
Yeah, so it's a linear relationship between velocity and momentum. But I would offer up kinetic energy. So that's one half MV squared. So now we're looking at velocity squared. So at the end of the stroke, if it hasn't been dragging a plane along, when it gets to the end of the stroke, it's going to be a lot faster. We'll take that a lot faster, that difference or delta, and square it. That gives you an idea of the amount of energy that needs to be dissipated by the water break at the end. So I think the amount of energy basically overwhelmed the water break, and it led to structural damage within the piston itself, if you will.
And I believe that was Catapult 1. Did you guys end up?
It was.
Did you end up using it again, that deployment?
We did much later.
Wow. So weeks, months, something like that.
Yeah.
All right. Let's
see.
You know
what's a good one here is, and then the follow-on is, how common is a nose gear / launch bar failure? So once again, what is the launch bar?
Launch bar, we talked about on episode 11 and 12, or I think just 12, but it's the bar on the front of the nose that lowers and goes into the shuttle, and it pulls the whole airplane off. But I would argue, I don't know your experience, I can only think of one episode, and that's Bashers. Similar question for arresting gear or hook failures. So not very often. Occasionally, a wire will break, a hook. I've never heard of a hook point breaking. I'm sure it has. I've just never heard of it. But, you know, not very often, I think, is a short answer.
Yeah, if you don't mind. So there's something called a ramp strike, right?
That's not the hook point failing. That's the hook point.
You're right. Being subjected to too much force, basically. So if a
blunt
plane,
force trauma.
Yeah, exactly. Blunt force trauma. So on a different, I think it was on the Reagan cruise, we had a Super Hornet come in too low. So he's coming in too low. And fortunately, his wheels made it and actually put skid marks on the round down. But his hook point grabbed the edge of the metal where the after the ship rolls down.
The very, very back of the ship.
Yeah, we call it a round down. And grabbed it and snapped off the hook point. So he was a no-brainer decision to divert him, obviously.
Did you have a good divert handy?
We did. We did. It worked out politically and geographically. It was very viable. So away he went.
Okay.
Yeah.
All righty. How about from Ray? Ray asks, once the aircraft has cleared the shuttle at the edge of the deck, does the pilot have to raise the launch bar before retracting the gear, or is it handled automatically with raising the gear lever? Seems like the workload would be intense transitioning from hands-off during the launch to taking control of the aircraft at low speed and cleaning up for climb-out. Not just low speed, Ray, but low altitude. I guess that's why naval aviators are among the elite. I had to leave that part in because I never miss an opportunity. No. So actually, this is a great question because we did not cover this in episode 12. You, I know, were listening to part of it on your drive down the other day.
Yes.
So if you can, remembering what you heard Pappy talk about, can you fill in the blanks on what Ray is getting at here?
Yeah, so in the sequence, right, so firstly, before I give the long test pilot answer here, is the pilot is actually going to throw the switch in the cockpit to the up position.
There you go.
The shuttle is going to maintain tension on the launch bar to keep it in the down position. And then as soon as the launch bar clears the shuttle, which i.e. is weight off wheels, right, then the launch bar will automatically raise. So that is one less thing we have to do because as a single seat pilots, we like to do as much as possible on deck prior to going airborne. At least I did.
For sure.
So when it comes to, let's see, so I think I answered it. So in the sequence of events, if you will, there's going to be a wipeout to check the hydraulics.
Right? We did talk about that.
And you're going to run up the engines to check performance on there.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, my kind of cadence was to wipe it out, engines, oil, hides, launch bar up, turn, look, salute. And then after I saluted, my hand does not return to the flight stick. It's going to actually go up to what we call the towel rack.
Right.
So it's on the canopy bow, if you will. There's a little handle there. And did you guys talk about why Hornet pilots grab the towel rack as opposed to the launch bar? Or excuse me, the flight stick?
No, we didn't.
Okay. So I haven't read this anywhere, but from what I've heard, so this is maybe third or fourth hand information, is as you come off the flight deck at 60 feet, there's an updraft. Okay, because the carrier is essentially cutting through the air. The air has to go somewhere, so it's going to go to the sides of the boat. It's also some of it's going to come up.
Right.
So what will happen is it can actually increase the angle of attack, which I know you so artfully described with your hand, I believe.
I have to use my fighter pilot hand, yes.
Yeah, so it turns out you've got an aircraft that's going weight off wheels, so it's transitioning both for the pilot – mindset, but also for the aerodynamics of the jet. Weight off wheels, you're at a relatively low speed, right? You're still above stall speed, probably 33% above stall speed at least, right? But you are dirty, so things are against you, and then you increase the alpha. So if you increase the alpha in the jet, you're decreasing your stall margin, and guys supposedly had a tendency to see, hey, there comes the water, I really need to rotate, and they would actually over-rotate.
Right.
So from my knowledge is the flight control system is going to look at the air data computer, and once it goes weight off wheels, it doesn't want any, basically it doesn't want any human input because it's going to design itself to fly a flight path
Silly
that
humans.
Provides about 10 to 12 degrees alpha.
Right.
It was designed to fly fast and at treetop level, carrying 24 nuclear weapons. Today, it bristles with smart bombs and guided missiles. The B-1 bomber, called the Bone by those who fly and maintain it, is the most heavily armed bomber ever built. Sleek and powerful, the Bone remains a mainstay of American air power 50 years after its first flight. Hey everyone, this is Ken Katz, call sign Primetime, and my book, The Supersonic Bone, A Development and Operational History of the B-1 Bomber, tells the true story of this magnificent airplane. In this book, you'll read stories told to me by those who were there and see lots of great photos of the Bone. Anyone with an interest in modern military aircraft will enjoy reading The Supersonic Bone, available through the usual online retailers and aviation booksellers. Pick up your copy today.
So it will seek that position, and then that gives you time to bring your hand down. I never, well, I did at the beginning, but I just left mine on my knee.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
But that's why it was there partly.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, then by the time you get your wits back about you, it's gone off the end and it's rotated up. Just to go back, though, on the launch bar, on the Facebook page, every month we have a new background picture. And I want to say it was February, we had a picture of a hobo jet back when they had Charlie's.
Yeah.
It was coming off the waste catapult, and the photographer was up on the bow, kind of where they come off on that side. And the jet was just coming off, like the main gear were still on the deck, but the nose gear was off, and already the launch bar was up. So it's a pretty stout spring
Absolutely.
That is trying to push that thing up, but your shuttle is holding it down. So when you in the cockpit put the switch up, there's a little light that will tell you if you have a problem. It'll go red, but otherwise I think it just goes out, right?
Correct.
And if it shows red, you have a problem. We don't want to get into that. But the moment you get to the end and the shuttle stops, but you don't, that spring will fling it up and that thing will come up in a heartbeat. And it was, like I said, already up even before the main gear were off the deck
oh, wow.
in that
That's
picture.
Yeah,
I'll have to send it to you.
I think it's hydraulic fluid at 3,000 PSI that holds it down until you get in the shuttle, right? So, and then basically you throw that switch up and now the hydraulic pressure is removed. So just like you said, it's purely tension on the shuttle.
Cool. All right, that was Ray. Let's see, and I guess that's why naval aviators are among the elite. Do we need to talk about that?
Yeah, we should. We should expound. So, Ray, thank you.
Anyway. All right, well, we have just a few minutes left.
I got one for you, if you don't mind.
Go ahead, yeah, please.
So Ray here talks about the it's a very intense transition from hands-off during the launch to taking control of the aircraft. So, cat shots day and night. How did you feel about the day shots versus the night shots?
I think just about anything that had to do with night I hated.
I totally agree, dude. So, Ray, if you could imagine the carrier flight deck is outlined with lights. There's not a lot of lights on board because it disturbs our night vision, right? But also it's not tactically very savvy, right, to have a giant beacon out there. Hey, look at us. Come shoot us, right? So the minimal lights that are on the flight deck and wands predominantly at night, like you guys talked about with the yellow shirts, the green shirts and all that, there are very few light sources at night. And then when you get pushed off the front and you feel that oomph as you go weight off wheels and you just a minor settle, it can be so dark. You know what I'm saying? You could have an overcast layer and the moon is above you. Ray, I honestly felt like I walked into a closet and shut the door. It was so disorienting.
No, it's like someone shoved you into the closet.
Well, that's true.
Because you lose your peripheral light, to your point,
yes.
Which gives you a sense of up and down. And you all of a sudden are in the dark. And like you said, if it's overcast or no moon or whatever, you could be upside down and not know it, especially since your ears just went through all this fluid shift that Cyclone talked to us about way back on an earlier episode.
Yeah.
So you definitely have to look at your heads-up display for us Hornet pukes. You had to rely on that.
Yeah.
And just don't do anything because George is going to set the flight controls where you need it, and you're going to climb away. So you just put the gear up. You take a moment to compose yourself, and off you go. All right. From Julie Martin, do you miss the work you did at China Lake? Very quickly now.
Hey,
this
Julie.
This is like a lightning rain.
I do.
Lightning
yes.
round, excuse me.
Yes. People, awesome. Engineering, awesome. Flight conditions, awesome. flying million-dollar-plus weapons for the first time ever. Got to chase a Tomahawk cruise missile at 200 feet and 550
Sweet.
Knots. Got to I stepped a little bit away from it as it impacted the,
Good idea.
The ship, obviously. Yeah, yeah, it's kind of a survival tactic. But epically fantastic, yes.
Living in Ridgecrest?
Boom.
You were saying awesome every time.
Oh. You know what? It was
You make the most of it, don't you? That's how it is in the military. All right. Well, that will do it for the listener question segment of this show. If it sounds like Sunshine and I were having a good time, that's because we were. We enjoy our job. We enjoy sharing it with people. So if you missed the video, you can still find it on our Facebook page, and we've also uploaded it to our YouTube channel as well. So I recommend you go check it out. Part of the reason I wanted to use that segment is we do talk about some of the aircraft carrier operations that we have been discussing in this series, both in episodes 11 and 12 and the lead-in for today. So with that, let's jump into our interview with U.S. Navy Commander and former Landing Signal Officer Jack Curtis, call sign Farva. All right, today we are talking landing equipment and hopefully day landings on carriers. Here to help me do that is Commander Jack Curtis, United States Navy, call sign Farva. Farva, welcome to the Pilot Podcast.
Hey, it's great to be here, Jill. Thanks for having a not fighter pilot on the show today.
Well, okay, what are you?
I'm a growler pilot.
Oh, well, that's close. All right, well, we'll get into that. All right, so we are talking day landings and carrier equipment, but before we do, have a little tradition here on the Fighter Pilot Podcast. We have an opening and closing question we ask everyone. So we'll start off with, where are you from, what have you done, and where are you now?
Well, my dad was in the Navy. I grew up kind of all over Southern California, actually, for a few years, and then we moved to Northwest Florida, not far from Pensacola, actually. Played a lot of sports in high school, kind of figured that growing up around Pensacola and being able to see all the airplanes flying around there made it look like a pretty cool job, and I thought I might like to try to do that. I was fortunate enough to get selected for an ROTC scholarship and was able to use that at the University of Florida. Miraculously made it through there in 4 years and was selected for pilot training in the Navy. Joined the Navy, see the world, went back home in Pensacola, started my flight training there, was fortunate enough to get selected for jets, went up to Meridian, Mississippi for a little while, trained up there. Selected Prowlers, which are now retired, moved up to NAS Whidbey Island, which is about two hours north of Seattle. Trained on Prowlers. I did my first fleet deployment around 2005, and that's where I kind of got into the LSO thing that we're going to talk about today.
Okay.
From there, I was a RAG instructor, so that's the replacement air group or the training squadron for that particular fleet aircraft. I was able to go and train new pilots and take them out to the ship and get them qualified. From there, I was really fortunate to get selected for what we call a CAG paddles job, and I think we'll talk a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm.
That was a fantastic tour, probably the best tour I've had so far. And after that, then I went transitioned to the new aircraft, flew the Growler for my next tour. After that, up to Newport, Rhode Island. And then spent 2 years doing staff work in Colorado Springs. Fortunate enough to get selected for command, and I'm on the training track now to go back and command a Growler squadron.
Outstanding. So before we talk about the process, let's talk about a little bit of equipment. On previous episodes, we talked about the catapult equipment. Let's talk about the arresting gear equipment now. It resides back where the wires are. It's one deck below the flight deck. And how does that work? What happens when an aircraft touches down and grabs one of those cables?
It's hydraulics. And I'm not an engineer, but I think I can explain it a little bit in the sense that when you apply a whole lot of hydraulic pressure to something, it creates a lot of tension, a lot of resistance. And so when the aircraft, anywhere between 33, 36, up to 54,000 pounds, comes aboard the aircraft carrier, there's a lot of force that needs to be stopped quickly. And so the arresting wires themselves, the part you see across the flight deck, that's called the cross-deck pennant that the aircraft's hook engages, is actually connected on both sides to even longer wires that go down, like you said, below the flight deck and into engine rooms down there. And that's where the hydraulic pistons are that are attached to large, they call them sheaves, but really what happens is when that cross-deck pennant that's engaged by the aircraft's tail hook starts to pay out, it's connected on both sides to more wires that go down, and as they are pulled out, the hydraulic pressure increases, and that's what allows the aircraft to stop. It's extremely violent, it's extremely loud, but it's also extremely effective, and it's been proven for years and years to be very effective and largely very, very safe.
Right. How thick are they, roughly?
The way the wires are constructed is that there's a line of hemp that is the foundation of this, and then they're braided and wrapped in steel, and when it's all said and done, they're about an inch to maybe an inch and a quarter in diameter. And so when you think about the fact that a very heavy aircraft is engaging this and using it to stop, it doesn't really look that substantial, but it does the job.
For sure. I don't know about you, but I've given a lot of tours on F-18s. People will look at the tail hook and they'll say, that's it. And then if they're near the arresting gear and they get a chance to see that pendant, they'll say the same thing. That's it. That brings, like you said, what, 55-ish thousand pounds. And, oh, by the way, when we touch down, we're not going to idle and trying to reduce the pull on that wire. We're doing just the opposite, aren't we?
We are. Every time that we touch down on the flight deck, we go to full power. And we do that so that if we miss the wire, we have the energy on the aircraft so that we can safely get airborne again and not dribble off the end into the water. We'd like to be able to use the airplanes again.
Yeah, for sure. Now, do those wires ever break?
Unfortunately, they do. In fact, I distinctly remember I was holding overhead an aircraft carrier on the East Coast one day back in maybe 2003, getting ready to come down and do some landings for practice. And I'm listening on the radio, and there was an F-18 that came down and landed. And as soon as he landed, everything looked normal. But as the arresting gear, especially the cross-deck pennant that we referenced, as it paid out, it snapped right at the apex of the wire, if you will.
Wow.
So now there's nothing holding that aircraft that's at full power. There's nothing holding it back. And it dribbled off the end. Thankfully, the pilot ejected. Quick reflexes and very good recognition of what happened. He ejected, and he was safely picked up out of the water to tell a good story. But so sometimes they do break. It's very, very, very rare.
Right.
And the reason why it's so rare is because we've put a life cycle on these wires. We don't use them beyond about 100 arrested landings per wire. And so what that allows us to do is to keep a known amount of life in these wires so that we don't end up with nasty surprises.
Sure. So someone up in the tower next to the air boss is probably keeping track, a little checkbox or something on how many landings on each one of these. And I've heard they'll actually move them, right? So we try to hit the number three wire, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But if the three wire starts getting high, can't they swap it with maybe the number one wire, which doesn't have as many, to try to make it an even count, or will they just let number three get to 100 and then switch it out?
They can do that, and I think maybe later in the show or in your next one, we may preview this new technology. It's called PLM, and it's an entirely different way of landing aircraft on ships, and it's so predictable and it's so precise that what they're finding is that it's wearing out spots on the flight deck and it's wearing out the target wire, which, like you said, is normally the three wire. It's wearing those out really quickly because it's putting the aircraft down in the same spot every time. And so you'll talk to some air bosses that are out there, and they're saying just what you referenced, is they can move the wires around a little bit to share the load and share the fatigue life.
Okay. Now, in that episode where the wire broke, or in general, what happens to the wire that's broke? I mean, it's got all that tension on it. Now it's free. What happens to it?
Well, that's a great question. And if you want to visualize, take a rubber band, cut it in half, and you've got two people that are holding each end of it, and you just keep walking further and further and further apart from each other, and then one person lets go of their end. Obviously, that rubber band's going to come flying back with a lot of force. Now, let's say it's not a rubber band. Now it's that steel wire. It's an inch or so in diameter, and it comes flying back towards where it came out of the deck, and it can be extremely dangerous. It can be very lethal. Mm-hmm. In that case, I think it damaged several aircraft. It really seriously damaged a couple of our sailors that were working on the flight deck. And what you'll see sometimes is a lot of lower extremity injuries because you've got this wire that's just whipping across the flight deck. Yeah. And I think you can find a video online of this, and you'll see what happens to one very quick reacting and very fortunate sailor. He recognizes what's going on. And then immediately starts jumping, and it almost looks like he's skipping rope. But what he's doing is he's jumping over this retracting wire. Not all the sailors on the flight deck were fortunate that day. Thankfully, I don't think anybody died that day, but I know there were some pretty serious injuries.
Well, we definitely talked about how dangerous the flight deck is on the previous episodes, and I think the listeners gotten a good sense of that already if they didn't have it before. So, all right, so these cables are about as thick as our forearms. I mean, for those of us who only exercise on occasion and aren't particularly buff. And again, not particularly huge, but they are good enough with those pistons below deck to bring an aircraft flying in at what? What's a typical airspeed an F-18 or EA-18 is coming aboard at?
Well, just generally speaking, about 145 miles per hour. And so I think in the past you've talked what that looks like in miles per hour or knots. And there's another important aspect to talk about here, and that's there's a tremendous amount of wind that's being blown over the flight deck. And what that does is that decreases the closure rate. So if you think about a headwind in an airplane, the airplane's not going to travel over the ground as quickly.
Right.
And so what the aircraft carrier will do is it will either seek the natural wind that's blowing across the ocean, or if there isn't any, the ship will make its own wind by using its propulsion plant to drive forward and create wind across the flight deck. And what that does is that decreases the closure rate of the aircraft as it approaches the landing area. And that does two things. It decreases the fatigue and the load on the arresting wires, and it also decreases the load and the fatigue on the aircraft.
So if we're coming aboard at 140 miles an hour, let's say, and there's a 30-mile-an-hour wind, then the equivalent is 110, and that can decrease some of that wear and tear. Like you said, though, if the ship has to make its own wind, then it's not always right down that angle we talked about on the previous episode, which is about, what, 10 to 11 degrees off of the center line that the ship is driving. So then we can end up with some crosswind.
We can. And if you look at a standard Nimitz-class carrier from overhead, you'll notice that the direction that the aircraft carrier is pointed and the direction it's traveling is not the same direction the aircraft are landing and the same direction that the runway is lined up. There's about a 10-degree difference like you referenced. What can happen a lot of times, though, when either the ship is making its own wind, like you mentioned, or what'll happen a lot with natural wind over the ocean, because that tends to be a bit less predictable. It can be gusty, and it's not necessarily always from the same direction, is you can get some of those crosswinds, like you mentioned. And we have very strict limits with how much crosswind we can accept, because it creates a lot of different effects for the aircraft, not least of which is it makes landing on the center line very difficult. Mm-hmm. And that's very important, because if you've ever seen a video or done it yourself, you know that there's not a lot of room from your wingtips to where the other aircraft are parked. And if you start looking at bigger aircraft like the C-2 Greyhound or the E-2 Hawkeye, they have very large wingspans. And being on center line is very important to those aircraft.
You're right, even more so than the rest, but it's important for all of them, because if you land off center, you can be pulled more one way or the other because of the arresting gear engines.
You can, and what's interesting about the arresting gear, especially some of the technological updates they've made recently, is they call it auto-correcting, I think, or auto-centering. So if you engage that wire a little bit off of center line, or you engage it with a little bit of a drift in one direction or the other, it will pay out at such a rate between the left and the right side that it will either slow down your drift or it will try to recenter you toward.
Wow.
And when it works, it's great. And when it doesn't, it can be a bit scary.
Yeah, I would imagine. You know, we didn't drive the point home on the arresting gear stuff, but just to close the door on that. So these are rooms below the flight deck, right underneath the wires. And then, of course, they're manned by petty officers. So these are guys wearing green shirts that we talked about before. And so someone will tell them what's coming down next, or maybe it's even dialed in from somewhere else. But the resistance or that hydraulic pressure you talked about, it'll change from landing to landing. And sometimes these landings are only, what, a minute apart or something?
They are. It's a great question. And it is really important that the resistance for each aircraft is set differently, because what we try to do is we try to set a standard max weight for each aircraft. So if it's a Hornet, we'll typically set 36,000 pounds as the resistance, because we know that aircraft can't come aboard anything more than that. So 36,000 pounds would have it covered.
But if he's super light and dropped all his bombs and he's coming in at 31, let's say, is that a problem?
Not necessarily a problem. It can be depending on different wind situations or if we do some different things with glide slope, because we can change the glide slope a bit. But in most situations, no. So for a Super Hornet, the standardized maximum weight, or at least the standardized resistance setting that we're going to set, is 44,000 pounds, because we know that will cover anything they come back with, which is anything they come back with that's covered by their own aircraft manual.
Right.
So if they're breaking their own aircraft manual, then there's going to be some issues with the single weight setting that we use.
In other words, it couldn't take off with full fuel and full bombs and turn right around and land, because it's going to be not only too heavy for its own landing gear, but probably too heavy for the arresting gear as well.
That's absolutely
right. Because these are not smooth landings. These are controlled crashes, some would call it.
They really are. And I think to answer your question, your previous question, a little bit better, the way that this team works, and it really is a team, from everybody in the tower to the youngest sailors working on the flight deck to the even younger, if you can believe it, sailors that are working down in the engine rooms for these arresting gear. It's a big team effort. And what happens on the LSO platform, which is all the way aft on the port side of the ship, typically during the daytime, one of the sailors will have binoculars, real high tech, right? Stand out there with binoculars, and they'll spot the aircraft either while it's still in the pattern or at various points if they're coming in on straight ends. And they'll identify the aircraft with some flash patterns or just visually, because you can tell the difference between an E-2 and a Hornet.
Right.
And they will call downstairs on a sound-powered phone, and they'll say, next aircraft is a Rhino. And that's what we call the Super Hornet around the ship. They'll say, next aircraft is a Rhino. So now those sailors down in the engine room know that they need to dial up the standardized resistance setting for a Rhino. Fast forward a little bit, the way we do this at night, as each aircraft has a very distinctive flash pattern for its anti-collision lights, its strobes. And so what they'll do is they'll recognize that strobe pattern being different from a Hornet, from a Growler, from an E-2. And they'll do the same thing, though. They'll call down and they'll say, next aircraft down is an E-2. And then they'll set the appropriate resistance setting for that aircraft.
Well, and at night or in case three, we also have, I mean, the pilots are talking more than they do in the daytime. And so we also know the side number. And, of course, each side number is affiliated with a squadron, so we know it that way, too. But that's a good point. That's a good backup. All right, so let's get into the fun stuff here. I mean, and we'll talk about, we've got some other equipment we need to talk about, like the lens and, you know, barricades and MOVLIS and all that. But let's just get into a scenario, let's say, where it's cyclic operations. So we've got, let's say, 15 aircraft airborne. And generally, correct me if I'm wrong, but we'll have a little bit of everything up. So if there are still some Hornets in this particular air wing, then there'll be a couple of those, a couple of Rhinos, a couple of Growlers, probably one E2 generally, and a bunch of helos, which I won't say don't matter, but I almost did. And I guess I just did now. But in other words, for the point of our discussion, they don't. And maybe a COD or that C2 you were talking about coming from the beach. So if it's daytime, good weather, we can do this, as we've discussed before on the show, almost without making any communications at all. So talk us through what we would call the case one pattern, beginning with, let's say it's a 9 o'clock recovery. So if you and I are out there flying together and it's 8:45, we're probably done with our mission. And let's say you're leading. What's going on? What do we do to prepare ourselves to be ready to land at 9? And again, we did talk on previous at 9 o'clock. Of course, they have to do the launch first, but then sometime after that, depending on how many, and you know, by 9:15, we'll call it, you know, we're ready to come down. So what's happening, though, a few minutes before 9?
So a few minutes before 9, we'll have finished whatever training we were doing, like you referenced. Whatever kind of checklists that we need to accomplish to make sure that any switches or screens or displays we had up for our training are now back to where they need to be. And then we'll start pointing ourselves back toward the ship. There's a couple of frequencies and radio calls that we'll make as we work our way back there. But generally speaking, we're working our way back towards the ship. And, you know, it depends on the weather conditions. Sometimes you can see the ship from 20 miles away. Sometimes it's only a few miles before you see it. But during the daytime, for our scenario, it's nice. And each squadron in the air wing has a pre-assigned low holding altitude overhead the ship. In this case, we'll say that we're going to be holding at 3,000 feet. And so the way the holding stack works is that you've got aircraft that are holding overhead at 2,000 feet, 3,000 feet, 4,000 feet. And since we do have an E2 in this recovery, there's going to be somebody at 5,000 feet as well. And they're just holding it in a circle overhead the ship. And the way it works is everybody is flying overhead the ship at their assigned altitude. And the guys at 2,000 feet are really the ones who are responsible for kicking off this party. And the way they're going to do that is they're going to be flying overhead the ship, looking down and monitoring the status of the launch that you referenced. Because during cyclic ops at 9 o'clock, there's a launch that's immediately followed by our recovery. So they're going to be watching. And they probably have notes on their kneeboard from the airplane they looked at, which is the big flight schedule for the entire air wing. So they have an idea of how many jets are going to be launched at 9 o'clock, and they kind of keep track of that. So let's say they knew there were going to be 10 jets launched at 9 o'clock, and they see that there's two to go. They're probably going to, the handler and the air boss and the mini boss, maybe trying to get those last two jets launched off the bow so they can start doing what we call wrap the waist. Because remember, we have catapults that are also part of the runway that we're going to land on. So what they have to do is they have to get those wrapped, and that's a phrase they use. And really what that means is they get all the extra equipment stowed, they get the shuttles that are part of the catapults, they get those put in the right position, and they get that runway turned in from a launching runway to a landing runway. And so now that we're those guys at 2,000 feet are watching all this, and they want to be timing it. So they come down out of 2,000 feet, they descend, and they come up from behind the ship at 800 feet, and they're in the break about 350 knots,
Sometimes faster
and breaking sometimes earlier. And we can get to that in a little bit when we talk about grades, if you'd like.
Sure, yeah.
But you come in 800 feet, about 350 knots, and you roll the aircraft into a pretty good turn. You pull some Gs, and what you're doing at this point is you're trying to use that G and that turn and bring the throttles back to idle to decelerate your aircraft, get it down to an approach speed, get your landing gear down, your flaps down, get your hook down. And now you're in the pattern, and we can talk a little bit about that later.
Yeah, okay. So let me just expand on a couple things you talked about. So first you said low holding. So if you and I get done and let's say we only have so much fuel because we need to come back to the ship to land with enough fuel. Let's say we use up all our fuel early, but it's still 8:30. Well, we can't just come home and say, hey, we're here, let us board. We've got to hang out. So we also have what's called high holding. And that'll be what, up in the 20s typically. And that's just a safe place, if you will, when you're within 10 miles of the ship that we can hang out and relax and conserve fuel because we burn less fuel up at high altitudes than we do down low. But then also the cod, the C2, if he's coming from the beach with some distinguished visitors, correct me if I'm wrong, they'll sometimes be at like 1,200 feet, and they'll be the first to come down because they don't want those DVs getting any more sick than they probably already are.
Yeah, no kidding.
And then if we have tankers, as we talked about on episode 4, I believe it was, they'll be holding out above so that if anyone has any trouble, about 6,000 or 7,000, that they can hawk whoever's having trouble. But generally, once we're proficient, that's not an issue in the daytime. And then just real quick, a visual I tried on a different interview I did once on a different podcast. So imagine the ship is going north, and we typically think of that as going up. And let's imagine the face of a clock, and we'll put it at the 3 o'clock position. And so all the aircraft are holding overhead the ship, and they're going counterclockwise, and they fly directly over the ship at 3, and then they'll turn and fly over 12, heading to the, let's say, the west, and then over at 9, they're heading south, and then down at 6, they're heading back to the east, and probably a bunch of people's eyes just crossed. But I don't know, does that make sense there, Farva? I mean, that's kind of the circle that we fly over this thing, right?
It does, but it's a three-dimensional problem, though. So as you just described, you described the circle or the track that we're flying over the ground. But remember, we have people that are holding it 2,000, 3,000, right, 4, and all the way up like you just described. So as I was talking earlier, when our heroes at 2,000 feet decided to go down and break the deck, as we call it, they're mm-hmm. the ones who are the first ones in, and they want to be timing that so that as soon as the deck crew gets that landing area ready, there's somebody about to land. And that's how you know you've done it really well. But as soon as those guys at 2,000 feet start going down, the people that are at 3,000 feet, now they collapse, that's what we call it. We collapse the stack down. So if you were at 3, now you're at 2. And it goes, if you're at 4, now you're down to 3, and so on. And so what you're trying to do is you're trying to time it so that when the people at the altitude below you push down to go in for the break, you can now descend down to the next altitude. And if you have yourselves oriented correctly around the clock face, like you described, it all should work really, really well.
All right, well, we will have to leave it there. Unfortunately, we are out of time for this episode, but not to despair. Jack Curtis will be back on episode 14 to continue and conclude this discussion on day carrier landings and carrier equipment. And then after that, we will have a discussion on night carrier landings. I want to remind you that the views expressed in this presentation are the personal views of myself and my guest and do not necessarily represent the position of the Department of Defense or its components. So have a great week to 10 days. We'll see you back here for the conclusion of day carrier landings next time. See ya. Now, this is the awkward part because then I got to find the button. Oh, end live video. You want to do it? It's fun.
End live video?
Click right there.
I can?
Yeah, but you have to like wave and say goodbye too.
Okay, but pilots love buttons.
Okay, go ahead.
Right there?
Oh, one more. You got to
There's commit. Two. It's a two-button sequence.
How can I not think of a stupid word, controversial? Thanks to our title sponsor, National University. National University is committed to supporting veterans, active duty personnel, and military families through flexible online courses and master's and doctoral programs in high-demand fields, providing excellent career advancement opportunity. National University is a yellow ribbon school that proudly accepts the post 9/11 GI Bill and goes the extra mile by offering additional assistance to cover expenses that may not be covered by the GI Bill. To learn more, visit nu.edu/veteran.